The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton. John is the president of Etherton & Associates, and John is also a senior fellow at the National Defense Industrial Association and a co-author of NDI's recent report, Pathway to Transformation, NDIA Acquisition Reform Recommendations, which was issued last week. And I'm so fortunate to have John here. The listeners are very fortunate to have John here, one of the co-authors of that report, and set of recommendations to provide his insights on why it was done, the recommendations that were made, why they were made. It will be a great conversation. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, well, you know, first let's start at the beginning, so to speak, of this. And, you know, what was the impetus behind NDIA deciding to do this? And, you know, just the spark and what sort of drove the idea?
Well, back earlier this year, there was some contacts between Representative Mac Thornberry from Texas, who was a vice chair of the House Armed Services Committee, and appointed by the chairman, Buck McKeon, to be sort of the point person for a number of different reform initiatives that would come out of the committee. He had a meeting, as I was not present, but he had a meeting at NDIA early in the year to talk about how NDIA might help support that effort and get some information from an industry perspective that might be useful. That was followed up by a letter that was sent to many of the trade associations, including NDIA, at the end of March, with a number of specific questions. And that letter came from not only the House Armed Services Committee chairman and ranking member, but also from the Senate Armed Services Committee chairman and ranking member, trying to get more formal input from the trade associations and other interested parties on what directions the committees might look at next year for acquisition reform. So we took that as our starting point, built a process around that, went through the summer. We had a number of large meetings. We had working groups that were set up that gave us inputs. We took information from a number of other sources, did a review of the existing studies, of which there are many.
Many, right?
Yeah. And also had conversations with some of the senior acquisition officials in the Department of Defense to get an understanding of what directions they were heading. This was prior to the issuance of Better Buying Power 3.0, and so we had some conversations just to see where there were points of common agreement, where we had differences, and we tried to use all that to inform what we did.
Okay, great, and that's a great starting and jumping off point. And I think, you know, one of the things I found really interesting is even just the introduction of your report. And as you mentioned, there's been many, many studies, many recommendations made over the years, and we sort of keep, you know, it's like a broken record or back to the future or something. You keep getting back to, like, how do we fix defense acquisition? So, you know, one of the things that you address in the report is, you know, why has the defense acquisition system proved so difficult to fix or reform? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, reforms aren't necessarily fixing them. They could be making it worse in some instances. But from your perspective, you know, why is it so hard to fix?
Well, I think as the report, initial report, and at this point I want to give a lot of credit to my co-author, Will Goodman, who is over at NDIA, for the work that he did on this. We had a lot of conversations around sort of these broader issues, and came to the conclusion that a lot of sort of conflict is just built up in the system by the nature of our constitutional system and the way that we have the different parties sort of arranged, that nobody gets to be sort of the god of acquisition in the process. And so there is sort of built-in conflicts of intent and desires and things like that, and that's one of the things that you have to deal with. I also think that the system serves so many different interests, both on the government side and on the industry side and on the national level side, that when you put all of those interests into the mix, What you get out of it is largely the system that we have. And the question is, it sort of settles into this equilibrium. And I guess the question you have is there something that could be introduced, or some new capability or new thinking that could be introduced in a way that would sort of disrupt this historical equilibrium that we've been in for all these years, and maybe get us to a higher level of maybe efficiency or sustainability or affordability, not only with what comes out of the process, but with the process itself.
Right. Well, you know, that's the way you put it, equilibrium. It's, that's noted in the report. I think it's a great observation, is that, you know, the reforms, it's get recycled, or you could say, like, you know, most of us in the community, right, say, well, the pendulum is swung.
Right.
It's it's on a continuum that, you know, doesn't really change ever, right? It's just where you are on that continuum in terms of what reform is in vogue, or peeling back, quote, reforms. So I guess, you know, from when you look at it, what are the keys to reforming defense acquisition? Where would you start, or what are the key aspects of it? And then we can get into some of the specific recommendations.
I think what you have to look at is what's different this time. You know, what is going to be a different factor that will play into this process that will simply force it out of, or disrupt, I guess, the force is enough that it won't settle back into the historical equilibrium. And I think we have two things that we're working with now that we didn't have in the past. First one is we have much more capability to gather data about the actual performance of the process as it's actually occurring, and to put that data in some sort of a usable context. We have systems in place now that we're trying to drive the Department of Defense toward full auditability, for example. We have backbone business systems that are in place now. Companies are deploying similar systems in their businesses. And a lot of that information is already being gathered, and now we just have a way of understanding what is actually happening in the acquisition process in ways that were unthinkable even 10 years ago. So the question is, does that give us the ability to do different things, or to base decisions more on evidence than what we've been able to do in the past? So that's number one. And I think the other factor that we have is that we've tried a lot of different things, especially in the last 20 or 30 years. Some of those things have been successful, some of them were not. But we have now the ability to look at those things and understand what worked and why it worked, and even more interestingly, what didn't work and why didn't it work.
That's part of the data.
That's right. It comes from actually not only looking at the system sort of as a steady state sort of system, but also we tried to introduce new things. And those things were either resisted, or adopted, or they were adopted in some way perhaps that was different than what folks originally intended. But we have a lot of historical experience like that now to take into consideration, and a lot of those considerations are what informed our recommendations.
Right. Is there a third element of this is that the budget mission imperative? You know, just is that pressure on understanding we don't have sort of the money we used to have,
right,
to focus on defense, creates an imperative that let's really take a look at the system and how we can address some of this?
I think that really gives a lot more energy to the effort. In the past, we've had a problem in keeping everybody at the table to sort of look at things and sort of persist in trying different things to the point where you actually get results and you can wait for the results. Everybody, in a sense, trying to get them to be patient in the way we do this. And I think now the imperatives of coming up with an affordable, not only a process, but a process that gives us affordable outcomes in the current budget environment is very strong right now. So I do think that's a factor that really adds a lot of energy to the effort this time.
So, you know, along those lines, we can, there's a number of different recommendations in different areas, mm-hmm, in the report. And is it, you know, just to recap, is that the overarching theme is being able to take the information that we have now, be able to analyze it, you know, figure out what works and doesn't work. You have the budget imperative. And then, you know, one thing that the report also talks about just generally is accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Can you address that a little bit?
Yes. I think one of the issues that we've heard from a number of different sources is we have so many different players and so many different stakeholders involved in the process at so many different points. And one of the solutions in the past, whenever a problem comes up, is to add a new layer or a new office or some new function into that process to try to improve the outcome. that accountability has really become very diffuse right now. And so one of the recommendations that we made was essentially to try some experiments to try to model what accountability could look like in a form that would likely be adopted in the system, that we could actually test some concepts in major program management and see what that looks like.
With that, you know, just a lot, keeping, you know, pulling that string a little bit, you know, with regard to accountability, is it does a tolerance of greater risk have to accompany, you know, that accountability? I mean, you know, I could see, you know, just having worked in government for a couple decades, you know, the accountability can also sort of create, I won't say, you know, just like a risk-averse approach. Like, you know, I've got, everything's got to be, it's all the I's need to be dotted, the T's crossed before I'm willing to sign my name to something. You know, I know that's a leadership issue as well, right. But is that also, you know, some greater tolerance of risk? Is that an aspect that, from a cultural perspective?
I think that's clearly one of the elements of this that would have to be addressed. And one of the things that we did in looking at this, we did a pilot program to test sort of streamlined and increased accountability approaches. We specifically said in there, or suggested to Congress when they look at this, that they limit this to programs with a total estimated acquisition cost of $50 billion or less. If you look at the list of ACAT 1 programs, that would put you at the lower sort of half of the large programs. And we did that deliberately partly to address the issue that you had mentioned, is that if you pick one of the very, very largest key programs that an agency might have, you're much more likely to basically bring out the most resistance from folks who would be concerned about the risk of failure, rightly concerned about it, and would resist any change from the current process that we have for that reason. And so what we wanted to do was try to set up a model that would actually be more acceptable to the system as a whole, get into some of these risk issues, but at least give people a sense that they're not betting the farm by selecting a program as one of these pilots. But clearly, at some point, if you're going to try to have some measurable improvement that would flow from increased accountability, folks are going to have, I mean, risk is going to have to be part of that equation. And the way we tried to attack it in this case was to suggest that the program manager work very closely with the service acquisition executive so that in a sense, both offices would be sort of yoked together.
Right, on the same page.
On the same
tied,
page,
you know,
right.
Your success is my success,
correct.
Now, John, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates, and we're talking about the pathway to transformation, NDIA's acquisition reform recommendations. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, the president of Etherton Associates. He's also a senior fellow at National Defense Industrial Association and one of the co-authors of Pathway to Transformation, NDIA Acquisition Reform Recommendations, particularly focusing on defense acquisition reform. And John, it's interesting, you know, I read the report and it's, you know, one of the things that really struck me was the format and the fact that there are actually some very specific recommendations. Can you talk about, you know, how you came up with the format, why it's the way it is, and you know, you're obviously responding to the stakeholders in general, but go ahead.
Well, the way we approached this was, first of all, the request came from Congress. I worked on the Senate Armed Services Committee for 14 years, and basically in my portfolio were these acquisition issues, and so I've had a lot of experience in working with things that proposals or drafts or whatever that would come to us in different formats. And one of the things that I was getting clear signals from, especially from the House Armed Services Committee people, was they were most interested in actionability. Okay, so we had a number of different approaches that we could take in this report. We made a decision relatively early on not to spend a lot of time on problem statements, because we felt that the prior acquisition reform reports covered those in spades, and people could basically have a whole closet full of those things if they wanted to look at it. Where our contribution could be was really focusing on things that could be made actionable. And in order to really propose things that were actionable, we felt we were sort of obliged to provide bill and report language for every one of the recommendations that we provide, and we did that, either amending existing law or creating new legal authority. And sort of as an aside, although there are some new requirements on reporting and things like that embedded in the report, there were very specific reasons for including those things, and primarily it was to get the Congress more engaged in a number of different areas where we didn't feel that they were at least institutionally engaged as they could be. But for the most part, in proposing legislation, frankly, what we were looking at was new grants of authority and new flexibilities that we could provide, and it wasn't 100% that way, but that was the major thrust. When you look at Congress, there's only three tools that they have in their toolbox. One is they can pass laws to address a problem. The second thing they can do is either provide more money or withhold money for things that that they want to try to do or not do, or have the executive agencies not do. And the third area is oversight. And so that was a relatively narrow set of things that that could be proposed. And so it sort of walks you down a certain pathway when you look at your recommendations from that perspective. But that's why we felt that we had to take the position that we did. And a lot of the recommendations were chosen because they could flow easily down one of those paths, as opposed to other things that may be more in the purview of the executive branch.
Right. And I mean, from my perspective, I mean, you know, I think this is a compliment. You've sort of made it easy for them in the sense that you've provided them with specific proposed legislative language that can be addressed as a starting point, even right. For something else. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the recommendations, and they're divided into sort of three general areas, right? Authority and accountability, matching requirements to resources, mm-hmm. and evidence-based decision-making. And let's talk a little bit about authority and accountability. And right. I know, the first thing that struck me is this idea of a Defense Streamlined Programs Pilot Authority. Mm-hmm. So what is that?
Well, that's what we talked about in the last segment. Essentially, the idea is a new way of sort of modeling accountability in a fashion that would be designed to succeed. I was involved back in the mid-1980s in a program called Defense Enterprise Programs,
mm-hmm.
and there's some common elements between that approach and this approach. But where we really differ in what we're doing here is in terms of the scope of the programs that we recommend be considered, because, and again, our experience was in the 1980s program that the services tended to bet the farm on some very large programs, which then brought the oversight and the other communities out of the woodwork because of the fear of what would happen in the event of a program failure, and it really impaired the results. The other thing that we also try to do with this is to decide what it was we wanted to test. Not try to test every new idea on program management that's out there. There's really nothing in here on budget issues so much as there are things dealing with streamlining specific requirements and giving the program managers under this program the authority to waive non-statutory requirements. But also to seek in an expedited fashion any sort of waivers from existing statutory requirements that might not exist in law. And that was really the focus of this. We also tried to set it up so that, again, you would have the service acquisition executive more or less yoked with the program manager so that there would be accountability at the right levels and both positions would have a real stake in a successful outcome, and to make that really clear up front. Again, I think that was another flaw in the original design of what we had done with the Defense Enterprise Program. So this is a different approach, but essentially what it's intended to do is provide at least modeling of different concepts of accountability to see if there's a better approach that we
flexibility
can,
combined with accountability.
Right.
So one that really caught my eye is, from my perspective and what I do, is innovation through the commercial marketplace.
Right.
What is that recommendation and what was the impetus for it?
Well, we were looking there to try to address something that many people have been talking about over the last couple of years, and it really came up quite a bit in the conversations in the working groups and the meetings that we had over the summer. And that is the situation that we see now where, and you and I have talked about this on the other shows, where we're starting to see a more of a divergence between the practices in the Department of Defense with respect to purchasing and what things are happening in the private sector and the commercial marketplace. And this is really moving along a number of different areas. On the one hand, I think every day it seems in the commercial marketplace we're coming up with new concepts of value and how you calculate value in making an acquisition decision. All of us as consumers are getting bombarded with different offers by providers of different goods and services all the time with offering us different approaches to value. And the department seems to be really stuck on a few things that deal on a transaction-by-transaction basis and really relate mainly to lowest price. And if we're going to keep the any sort of alignment between the Department of Defense and this very dynamic private sector, commercial sector, which is producing some of our most advanced technologies, we've got to figure out a way to have the department at least an open, more openness to those different approaches, not only in terms of value, but also in terms of how we look at in general sort of the state of the practice of the commercial sector. So we had conversations about this in the summer. Many of the people in the government say, oh, we're already doing this or that. So we felt that the most important thing here was to start taking an inventory of what the government is actually doing, try to start identifying some of the barriers that might be out there, and also have a separate effort really looking at different ways we could think about value within the context of the way the government spends money and the way that other things that would be very
difficult to change. And meets
mission.
Right. So
the government is not the commercial market. It's different. There are things there that will be different no matter what we do. But nonetheless, we need to start looking at that as an issue and a problem and really try to get a better understanding of what things, the different approaches we could consider. And frankly, we didn't have in our mind a nice blueprint to say this is how you do it. This is an area where we felt that gathering increased analysis, gathering more data was really appropriate as sort of a longer-term proposition.
Right, sort of taking a strategic approach
right. To
trying to figure out how to measure value. And
right.
Attain value versus like a one-off, like I'm going to do it for this procurement,
right.
And here's my trade-off kind of approach.
Right.
Right. Well, speaking of value, John, we do have to take our next break. So when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates, and we'll continue our discussion of Pathway to Transformation, the NDIA's acquisition reform recommendations. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates. John is also a senior fellow at the National Defense Industrial Association and a co-author of Pathway to Transformation, NDIA Acquisition Reform Recommendations. And John, let's talk a little bit about the second sort of grouping of recommendations that the report makes, and it's matching requirements to resources. And I guess one that's very near and dear to my heart as a lawyer and just someone who's frustrated by the process, quite frankly, and layering on of requirements is there's a recommendation regarding statutory sunsets and review of existing law. I like the idea of sunsets. Things need to be justified to come back and just should go away in some instances, right? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, in matching requirements to resources, let me clarify what we meant by that, because most people, when you talk about requirements to resources, are talking about designing systems to fit mission requirements or whatever.
Sure.
And the money that would be available, and it's an affordability. That's not what this is about. This is more about looking at the workforce and the system we have to actually implement the various requirements for acquisition generally, and whether, in fact, anybody is trying to match up all the different things that we're layering onto this process, telling our acquisition professionals, now here's 15 other new things that you have to do, but recognizing that we have only so many people with so much experience in education and so much time and attention, and you have to really pick what are the most important things that you want that workforce to do, both inside the government, frankly, and in industry. The sunset idea was one sort of, we provided to Congress a couple of ideas for doing some sort of a major legislative review, which would be the first one that we've had since the early 1990s in the Section 800 panel. I had suggested in some testimony earlier this year to both the House and Senate Armed Services Committees that they consider forming another panel to look at, in totality, all of the current laws sort of governing acquisition, not only in the Department of Defense, but government-wide, and then give that group some time to come back maybe in a couple years with some ideas. And frankly, there's not a lot of interest right now in yet another commission. People just don't
send commissioned out.
Commissioned out. So I said, we said, okay, if we're not going to do that, let us give you an alternative approach, which is to say, let's do a more phased review around statutes that are sort of clustered around certain areas, so that you have some sort of an orderly way to do that. And simply, you know, as a matter of law, in one of the authorization bills, for example, they could simply say that on such and such a date, you know, these following statutes will be sunsetted. Not to say that the law should go away necessarily, or that they were bad or anything else, but simply to force a conversation around the current utility of the law in relationship to the reason it was originally passed. Other changes that should be considered in light of experience or technology or different ways of doing business, just to force some sort of an orderly review. It would take longer to do that, and it would put the Armed Services Committee sort of in the center of that effort to try to sort through all those comments. But at least it would keep things from being sort of passed and forgotten and enacted. And it would, I think, give us a little more of a vital sense that as the world around us is changing, we need to be constantly relooking at the requirements in the acquisition process and what we're asking our people to do, to see if these are the best ways to approach a problem, or whether they're even still relevant.
Right. And to me, I mean, it's such a great idea, because I just remember, and, you know, I think we've all thought, wow, I mean, if you know, I'd rather have something done in regulation than by statute, because the statute never changes, right? In regulations, at least you have a shot. There's not something that you could revise over time and take you had a bit of more control of reviewing and that sort of thing, getting feedback on. But once a law is passed, like, it's like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so often they're not looked at again.
Right.
And I really think
we fix that problem.
Right, right. And yet things change, and we get new information. Some of the reviews of the performance of the acquisition process, for example, have thrown into question some of the more recent changes and called for a review or an adjustment. So what we were trying to do is provide an alternative to a commission. But you'll also notice in the report there is a commission in there as well. I think if people get sick of it and they want to throw in the towel and say we'd rather have a group of experts give us a more holistic view, then we provided suggested language for how to do that as well.
Right. So I also know, you know, one of the other recommendations in matching, and I love the description you made of, you know, matching really the acquisition resources to the process requirements, right, and how to execute. You know, there's a recommendation regarding reducing inefficient audit practices. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this was an area we've heard a lot of concerns expressed, especially from the industry side, about the Defense Contract Audit Agency, some of their procedures, the amount of burden that folks feel that the day-to-day interaction in some cases has. At the same time, folks will notice that there is not a lot of statutory language with respect to Defense Contract Audit Agency or even audits in general. So we felt that really an approach here, because it's been my personal experience and the experience of others, that at least there's an openness on the part of the DCA leadership when people have specific issues that are of concern, and they can bring suggested solutions, that they're willing to sit down and work with folks, that to try to provide at least some recognition of that, some measurement of that, as a way of encouraging the conversation. And also, we have language in there, and this is the annual reporting that DCA currently does. We added a couple of requirements, and one of them would be that they talk a little bit about how they're sort of aligning across the regions and across the various activities common policies and procedures, so that there is more consistency across the enterprise in terms of how audits are conducted and what practices are put in place.
I mean, that would be a huge, that alone would be a huge, you know, I think, time saver and money saver, both for government and industry, if you get some more uniformity in how you look at these things. It just, and you can talk to companies, and they're pulling their hair out, because there's just different processes, and even just for data reporting, just by way of example as well, different formats, different departments or agencies ask for data different ways. It's just it just does increase transactional costs for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is can you talk a little bit about, because there's recommendations here with regard to both improving the management of the civilian acquisition for workforce and the military acquisition workforce. And, can you explain the thought process behind the, you know, two sets of recommendations there?
Right. Well, first of all, you're dealing with two very different systems, and we try to recognize that in the way we constructed the report and the way we structured it. On the civilian side, the focus there was really to look at some of the tools that the department currently has for maintaining the workforce and improving its capabilities. One thing in particular that we were very interested in was to try to get the Defense Acquisition Workforce Development Fund process on a more of a steady state permanent basis than it currently is right now, and get the funding in a little more stable fashion. And so we basically made some recommendations there that would do that. And again, it would involve changing the legislation. The other area that we looked at with respect to the workforce is to basically take some of the things that we're aware that the department currently has underway, that they've reported to Congress in a number of reports and in congressional testimony, such as their current competency modeling process they're doing for the contracting workforce, as well as some of the look that they're giving for the qualifications and sort of a relook at the Defense Acquisition Workforce Improvement Act, and give those a little more of an institutional basis with a direct congressional reporting requirement. The other thing that we also felt was important was when the reporting is done on the human capital planning process, which we recommended be expanded in the current law to provide Congress with periodic reporting, is that one of the elements of the reporting should also be on the way that the human capital planning process was accommodating the new imperatives and the new requirements that were being added to the process by statutory or other changes in the law, so that, again, we weren't treating this as a static issue, but recognizing the fact that Congress has been adding a number of new requirements, and that we've seen also some things coming down through the regulatory process, which will require that the capabilities of the workforce be improved in order to cover those things as well, and maybe other things that they are currently doing, they would have to adjust downward. So we felt that that had to also be a part of the process. So that's on the civilian side. On the military side, we were also looking at the fact that you have a military promotion personnel management system, which serves a lot broader purposes than just trying to get people in the acquisition process that are qualified on the military side. And so what we've tried to do is recognize that there is this broader process, this broader imperatives, and recognizing that acquisition sometimes in that process has gotten short shrift, especially in the event of any downsizing, and to try to put some tools in place which would allow for acquisition to be recognized as an important function within that larger process and to be supported adequately through different recognition of service and promotion opportunities and things like that. That will be a very tough sell, I think, for folks on the Hill to try to take that and reconcile it with these larger purposes.
But
at least we gave them language and said, here's one way that it could look like if you want to go down that road.
Okay. Well, thanks, John. And we do have to take our next break. My guest today is John Etherton of Etherton Associates, and we are talking about the Pathway to Transformation NDIA Acquisition Reform Recommendations, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates. He's a senior fellow at the National Defense Industrial Association and co-author of Pathway to Transformation Acquisition Reform Recommendations, particularly focusing on DOD. And John, you know, before we turn to the last sort of, you know, bucket of recommendations, you know, there's one recommendation that we haven't discussed under matching requirements to resources, and I found it interesting, is raising the simplified acquisition threshold. And you've got an interesting approach to that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. What we were looking for here, Roger, was some way to start at least engaging the conversation around the small business programs and what we could do in a constructive way to assist efforts by small business to sell their services and their goods to the federal government, and at the same time not get into an issue of small business versus mid-tier versus large business, but really try to look at this in a way that at least starts us down a road where we can look at what's, you know, in the best interest of all the parties. And so we had a lot of conversation around this and basically came up with the idea of proposing raising the simplified acquisition threshold, the statutory threshold, from I think 150 to 250,000, and that number actually is much higher now because of the inflators that are put on it through the regulatory process. But also, and with that, we had proposed simply raising it as it is now, which means that the small business reservation would go up as well as the simplified acquisition threshold. The kind of novel idea that we try to throw out on the table for people to consider was the idea of then going an additional step, and that is raising the simplified acquisition threshold again from 250 to 500,000. And in that segment or that band, not including this small business set-aside requirement, so that all businesses, essentially, it would be sort of a full and open potential there. And we ran that by the small business community folks that we talked to, as well as some of the mid-tier and some of the larger companies that for whom those smaller dollar value contracts really do represent important business, and got a consensus around the idea that that would be worth proposing, because it would actually benefit everybody. The small businesses with the less of the paperwork burden and some of the other things with the simplified acquisition threshold would still be at a position where they might compete. And again, it would be an opportunity that would not be at the expense of one size or the other. We got consensus around that, so we put that in. I think we're going to have a larger discussion around small business programs and how we make them more effective or different or whatever, and still achieve Congress's goals for small business and support agencies' missions. But that's a conversation to have as we go down the road.
Okay, great. And just an interesting idea, just trying to take advantage of some flexibilities and that are available on the simplified acquisition threshold, make them available to all while at the same time, mm-hmm. increasing the set-aside dollar amount to right. $250,000. So let's turn to the last segment. I know this is one that, just when I've talked to you, whenever we talk, you always get back to evidence-based decision-making and, using data. Even we started the show talking about that. And can you talk about the recommendations there? You've talked about there's a GAO study that you're recommending with regard to complex systematic acquisition problems.
Right.
Technology. I'm interested in hearing what technology domain awareness means. go ahead.
Well, I'll just mention a couple things there. As we have had conversations, especially with some of the senior officials in the department, and we've talked to others as well, data are really sort of the currency of the realm, I guess, right now. And it really, as I mentioned at the beginning, sort of evidence-based or data-driven decision-making really seems to be a possibility that exists for us now that did not exist even 10 years ago. And so what we were trying to do was look at things where we may, A, not have had sufficient information to make a solid recommendation, and really to recognize that and to say we need to go back and look at this thing in more detail. And again, we provided terms of reference to do that. But as well as looking at existing processes that the department currently is deploying, say for ACAT 1 programs, and saying, well, what could we do for measuring acquisition performance? Let's start with some steps that maybe expand that same approach into ACAT 2 and 3 programs, and then hopefully beyond that into things that aren't programmatic at all in the longer term. And so we have a number of recommendations there to do that. On the GAO reports, we've tried to look at such issues as lowest price technically acceptable. Sort of, we have a proposal in there to go beyond what the GAO report that was issued last summer basically uncovered, to look at some more specific issues. Bid protests has been an issue that people have raised, although there are sort of arguments on both sides as to whether that's a problem or not a problem, or how it really drives the behaviors in the process. And so we've got an issue in that, and there are a couple of other things also that we've really tried to address with regard to IDIQs and things like that, where we heard a lot of information. It was largely anecdotal. We felt that it was at least worth exploring in more detail.
Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotal and urban myths and things right. going on out there. To get some real data and take a look at it, I think it's important at this point.
Well, and this was, as I said, sort of the third leg in the congressional stool of really trying to improve, give them some approaches on oversight of some of these things that may not be addressed for another year or two, but at least provide a better set of data that we can use to make more informed decisions later if people find that there's a real issue there that we need to approach.
Yeah. No, okay, so technology domain awareness.
Technology domain awareness is an existing program that the department is undertaking. This is an area really where an effort to try to get a better understanding of what is available throughout the industrial enterprise, new technologies, new R&D efforts that might be out there that we need to increase the visibility for defense purposes. And so this was an attempt to sort of enhance that approach and make it a little more comprehensive.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you about, because it sort of demonstrates the need for transformation. Is a couple of weeks ago, I saw a Wall Street Journal article where the headline was something about how the department, DOD, was concerned about, and I'm using different language, but concerned about, you know, the contractor R&D and the amount of, you know, funding that was being put in as a percentage and just in general that was being, but that companies were putting towards their research and development investments. You know, I think that says something about, you know, the defense acquisition system itself. I'd interested in your thoughts.
Sure. I mean, I think this is an issue that has been recognized in Better Buying Power 3.0, you know, the idea of how do we incentivize the investment. You've just got a lot of things working, I think, in this area at cross purposes right now. We have a sort of practices around intellectual property and rights and data that are driven by the desire to have as much competition as possible, which is a legitimate concern. But they're working across purposes, I think, with other things of inviting companies to bring their best technology or their best practice or process and make it available to the federal government. Issues about things like commercial item determinations and you know, the issues around that. So I think we've got some attempts to build some incentives and some attempts or things that are not intended to act this way but act as pretty strong disincentives for companies to engage in the government marketplace, especially the Department of Defense. And when you're in a situation like that, you really have to ask yourself from a company perspective, especially if you're publicly held and are answerable to the shareholders, what's my incentive to make some of these significant R&D investments in a case where I may not be able to retain control of my intellectual property? There may not be a program out there because of the budget instability that is a sufficient demand for this to really, you know, pay off in the long run. I mean, a number of other issues like that. So I think we need to really take a sober look at this and really try to understand what are some of the incentives that are out there in the current process for folks to make some of those investments, and what are the lack of incentives and the actual disincentives for people to make investments in R&D and recognize those for what they are and try to come up with some way of approaching that. In the report, we have some recommendations on intellectual property, which essentially are a reset to policies that we've had in place for a long time, but also for setting up a group from industry in different categories of industry as well as the government to do a revisit of a policy that's been in place since 1995. We're in a world now that's much different than that, and I think it's time we took a more fundamental look at the current guidelines and conceptual structure around the way we allocate rights and data and see if there are some fundamental changes that need to be considered to address some of the concerns I've heard on both industry and government side. So there's some of that in there as well. But I think there are a number of different things that when you look at R&D investment and the incentives, are tending to work at cross purposes.
Right. It seems to me, you know, it's you know, the focus on competition and intellectual property rights, it almost strikes me as it's a transactional concern. We want to make sure we have competition for this transaction, as opposed to a strategic concern. Because, you know, competition in the larger context in the commercial market is about people coming up with great ideas and being able to, frankly, exploit those ideas to execute in business, to make money, make profit, that sort of thing. That's big competition. It seems to me, you know, there's a focus on this, you know, smaller transactional competition. That's a fair way.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think it points to what I think is one of the overarching issues that we're probably not going to be prepared to talk about next year or even the following year, but I think in the longer term we really are going to have a serious discussion. And that is the degree to which the budget process and the way we handle the money in the federal government really drives a lot of the incentives and a lot of the behavior from both the government side and the industry side. And I think in this area is one that is really part of that. But that involves a lot of different stakeholders in OMB, the various financial operations, Congress, and because they have mandated a lot of that. That's a big conversation. But part of me suspects that unless we really deal with that as a fundamental issue, a lot of what we try to do on acquisition reform is really going to be overridden by the imperatives in that current process.
Right. Well, you know, on that note, John, we have to wrap up the show. You know, great effort, great report, great contribution to the debate and dialogue around our acquisition system. I'm going to have you come back. We talk about, you know, the progress and looking at the report, where, you know, the Congress is going with regard to potential transformation. So I want to thank my guest today, John Etherton. He is president of Etherton Associates, and we have talked about the Pathway to Transformation, NDIA, Acquisition Reform Recommendations, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.